Well, this morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the career of one of America's most celebrated athletes. He was a runner, very popular in the 1930s and 40s. He won a lot of money, became an American cultural icon. He got tremendous coverage in the press. In fact, in 1938, maybe his biggest year, he got more news coverage than either Franklin Roosevelt or Adolf Hitler. His name was Seabiscuit. He was a racehorse. Some people would say one of the greatest horses ever in the history of racing. This morning, we'll be talking with the author of a new book that is about Seabiscuit and the men who owned him, trained him, and rode him. Our guest is Laura Hillenbrand. She's been writing about thoroughbred racing for a number of years now. She's a contributing writer and editor to Equus magazine and has been there since 1989. Her work has also appeared in a number of other places, including American Heritage and Talk magazine, other specialty magazines that are all about racing. And she is the author of the book Seabiscuit, An American Legend, which is just recently out. It's published by Random House, and it's a great story. Even if you're interested in horses, you might love this book, but even if you'd think, no, that you're not interested in horses and racing, I think if you tried it, it would grab you pretty quick because the characters in it are fascinating. So it's out there in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. And, of course, as we talk this morning with our guest, Laura Hillenbrand, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Ms. Hillenbrand, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for talking with us. I think it's a really good book, and it's a great story, and maybe the reason that it is a great story is that it has so many great characters in it.
Absolutely. That's what attracted me to it. It's certainly not just the horse in this one.
Well, are you? I'm just curious about you. Are you one of those people that, who, when you were a little girl, were fascinated with horses, and that somehow became a lifelong interest, and that's the way you became a journalist who specialized in writing about horses and about racing?
Yes. My father had a farm that was next to the Antietam Battlefield in Sharpsburg, Maryland, and he had a lot of space there, and people used to drop off horses from the Humane Society, horses they didn't want anymore. They had a real motley crew of horses up there. And my sister and I would spend time riding them barefoot, helmetless, very risky stuff, but we really got hooked then. My father also took me to the races when I was five at a little track called Charlestown in West Virginia, and I was hooked from the first horse I saw.
It's in reading about Seabiscuit and just how famous he was, it's tempting to reach for comparisons with modern athletes. And I don't know if this is over the top, but it seemed to me that one might be justified in saying that Seabiscuit was the Michael Jordan of his time.
He was, and in some ways he was even bigger. And it's hard to believe, but he wasn't just a bigger newsmaker than Franklin Roosevelt or Hitler. He was the biggest newsmaker of that year of 1938. And I don't think you can say that for Jordan or Tiger Woods or anyone of that sort. To quantify how famous he was, he won a race up in Massachusetts in 1937, the Massachusetts Handicap. And it the following morning, a picture of him and an article on his winning the race spanned over the entire upper half of the Boston Sunday Globe front page. I don't think Jordan ever did that. So he was huge in large part because of the depression and escapism. Athletes were bigger than they are today.
I don't think that I would be able to look at a horse and to tell you, well, I don't know, maybe some horses I could, but to look at a horse and say, this horse is going to be a winner. And apparently, Seabiscuit was unlikely for that very reason, for the way that he looked. Seasoned judges of horse flesh probably would have looked at Seabiscuit and said, there's no way this horse is going to be Horse of the Year, much less win more money than any horse before.
Absolutely. He was very unfortunate in his appearance. He was short. He had very short little legs and a little cinder block of a body, a great big head, and his knees didn't straighten all the way. So So when he ran, one of his forelegs swung out in a very comical fashion. One of the writers of the day called it a duck waddle. He was funny to watch. He was nothing to look at, and he ran in these races called claiming races. They still run them today, where any horse that is in the race is up for sale for a certain set price, but you have to buy him before the race. And I don't know how many of those he ran in, probably 20 or 30, and he was never bid on once, which is quite extraordinary. He really, nobody saw what was in him until a trainer named Tom Smith took a look at him.
Well, we should talk about the characters here, and maybe we can start with the owner, Charles Howard,
okay.
What was sort of interesting and ironic about him is that this is a guy who made his living selling horseless carriages.
Yes, it's very ironic. This is a man who started out as, he was in the cavalry to start out with. He was a very ambitious man. This is at the turn of the century. He was in the Spanish-American War. And after the war, he became a bicycle repairman, and he always had this hankering to go west over the Rockies, like many Americans at the time. He wanted to see the new America. And one day, with 21 cents in his pocket, he went across the country and showed up in San Francisco and set up a bicycle repair shop there. And the automobile showed up at the same time in San Francisco, and it was not an auspicious debut. Automobiles were unreliable. They were noisy. They terrified all the local carriage horses, and they were banned in the city. The only people who bought them were very eccentric, rich people. There were no auto mechanics yet because there were hardly any automobile owners. So people started bringing their automobiles to Charles Howard, and his ambition just clicked when he saw automobiles, and he became fascinated. He started racing them, and then he went to Detroit, introduced himself to Will Durant, who was soon to found General Motors, and told him he was his man. I want to sell Buicks. And Durant sent him back over the Rockies with three Buicks to sell, and Howard couldn't sell them. No one wanted them. And his luck turned on an extraordinary event, which was the San Francisco earthquake. And when it struck and the fires came up after it, wagon horses were useless. They were killed in the earthquake, or they broke their legs in the rubble, and they were absolutely useless for saving people. But Howard's cars became ambulances. By one report, he actually drove them himself, going in and out of the fire to rescue people. And that was what turned people around on automobiles in San Francisco. And overnight, Howard was a millionaire. And he really drove the horse into extinction on the West Coast. He became the single biggest automobile distributor in the world.
He was also one of the investors in what was to become a very famous racetrack outside
yes.
L.A., Santa Anita.
Yes.
And the people there decided, I guess, that they really wanted to establish a big-time reputation for the track, and they created a race that offered the biggest purse in the world, $100,000, which in 1935 was real money.
It was real money. The average per capita income in the United States at that time was $432, and the purse for that race was slightly more than $100,000, all to the winner. So this was a big pot, and immediately everybody in America wanted to know who would win that race, and every good horse in America came to win it. And Howard, being one of the co-founders of Santa Anita, wanted to win the race himself. And that's what turned him around toward horses again. And he began looking for a trainer.
Let me real quick here just introduce again our guest. We're talking with Laura Hillenbrand, and she's the author of a recently published book, Seabiscuit, An American Legend, published by Random House. It is about Seabiscuit, who was a racehorse and a very famous one. Some people think one of the greatest American racehorses ever. If you have questions as we continue to talk, 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. Well, I'm sorry I sort of cut in on you there. I think you were about to go on and say some things about Tom Smith.
Tom Smith, the trainer. Here is Charles Howard, the owner's polar opposite. This is a man who began his life out on the real western frontier when it was still a frontier. He rode in the last of the cattle drives. He was breaking horses at age 13. And he broke Mustangs for the British in the Boer War and ended up in Wild West shows. And gradually, the automobile begins to make inroads on this frontier, and this horseman who really knew the ancient arts of horsemanship, he learned it from the Indians, he'd learned it from being out with these Mustangs and being out on the ranges, he becomes obsolete because of the automobile, because of Charles Howard's automobiles. And he ended up training one horse at a little track in Tijuana, Mexico, and living out of a horse stall. And someone introduced him to Charles Howard, who was looking for a trainer. And Howard's great strength was he could see potential in unlikely packages. And this old man, by this time Tom Smith, was no spring chicken. He knew horses, and Howard recognized it. And they formed a partnership and set out to find a racehorse. And the story really begins there. They went east. Tom Smith was standing by a track rail in June of 1936 at Suffolk Downs in Massachusetts, just outside Boston. And a horse, a very ugly horse, stopped in front of him during a post parade and looked at him. And Smith, for the first time, somebody recognized the talent in this horse. The horse was Seabiscuit. Tom Smith, who hardly ever said anything to anyone, said to the horse, "I'll see you again."
He actually said that to the horse.
He said it to the horse, yes. And which is more than he said to most people. He was the Indians called him Lone Plainsman, and the white men called him Silent Tom, and it was because he hardly ever spoke. The story was completed a month later when Charles Howard was at Saratoga Racecourse with his wife, and they looked down at a post parade and saw a very ugly horse. And Howard's wife Marcella thought he was quite funny looking, and offered to bet her husband a lemonade that the horse would lose. And her husband took the bet, and the horse won the race. It was just a cheap little race, but he won it. And she bought him a lemonade, and they started talking about buying the horse. And they got Tom Smith to go over and look at the horse, and it turned out to be the same one he'd seen at Suffolk Downs.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought the horse for $8,000, which was a bargain price.
Seabiscuit had good bloodlines. His father, his grandfather, was a very famous racehorse named Man O' War.
Yes.
And his father also was a fast horse named Hardtack. So you'd think with father and grandfather like that, you'd have a good horse on your hand. But somehow Seabiscuit his performance had been underwhelming before Tom Smith and Charles Howard came along, and Howard bought the horse and Tom took over the training. What was it that Tom Smith was able to do with Seabiscuit that no one had done before?
Well, Seabiscuit was, like his father, a very willful animal, a very obstreperous animal. His father, Hardtack, was a famous rogue. He fought everything. He was just insane, and to the point that they really couldn't train him, and they gave up on him. He was very fast, but just unruly. Seabiscuit was unruly in a different way. He didn't like being forced to do anything, and when anyone used any hint of coercion with him, he tended to pretend to be tired or get lazy, and he would slow down. If someone pulled on the right rein, he'd go left. If someone pulled on the left lane, he'd go right. And he didn't want to be forced to do anything, and that was the mistake his first trainer made, was trying to force him. What Tom Smith did was there was one critical morning. He took the horse out on the track. He wanted to see what he had just bought. The exercise rider got on, and Seabiscuit proceeded to plunge around the track, slow down when the rider asked him to speed up when the rider asked him to slow down. The rider was barely able to hang on, and Smith called out to the rider and just said three words. He said, "Let him go." And the rider let the reins go loose. The horse ran around and around the track, trying to irritate the rider, and the rider offered no resistance. And eventually the horse just got tired, walked back to the barn of his own volition, and Smith greeted him with a carrot. And it was that one lesson that taught the horse he would never be forced to do anything again. Excuse me. And from that day forward, the horse never fought a rider again. He was happy, and he was fast.
Hmm. Tom Smith, I remember reading in the book that here was a guy who seemed to be able to take horses that other people would have said were washed up, were all done, and in fact make them winners. What was it that this guy had that made him able to connect with animals, to understand them in that way, and to take animals that seemed to be broken and fix them?
I think he paid a lot closer attention to horses than most people did. I've spoken to people who would watch him work, and he would squat down on the floor in front of a horse he had just bought, and he would stay there without moving, sometimes for hours, just watching the horse. And he would, in his words, he would learn them. And he treated every horse as an individual, whereas a lot of his colleagues had formulas for training horses, one size fits all. Smith didn't do that. He understood his horses' minds better than other trainers did. And I think that was the thing that did it. And he used very odd techniques to train horses sometimes, and people would gather to watch what he did because they were so strange. He would, Seabiscuit, for instance, was quite frightened of the starting gate when Smith first got him. And this is a 1,000-pound horse. It's not a horse you want to be standing right in front of when he's rearing up and banging around in a gate. Well, what Smith did was he led the horse into the gate. He stood right in front of the horse, under the horse's chin, and whenever the horse would act up, he would just take a finger and tap the horse on the chest. And when the horse stopped acting up, he would stop tapping. He'd repeat it over and over, sometimes for hours, and by the end of the lesson, the horse would be completely docile. He felt safe. Horses felt safe in his hands. That was one of the exercise riders told me. He let the horses learn to trust him, and once they trusted what he was doing, they would run their hearts out for him.
Another important person here in this story was a jockey who was primarily the jockey for Seabiscuit, a jockey named Red Pollard. And one of the things that really struck me in that section where you're writing about him is what a terrible job being a jockey would be. And I don't know if it still is, but it's dangerous. The pay was bad, and the jockeys would put themselves through unbelievable stuff to keep their weight down.
Yes. It opened my eyes when I started researching this, just how bad it really was. First of all, the danger of it. It's still an extremely dangerous job. It's probably the most dangerous sports job you can have, much more dangerous than auto racing, for instance. In that era, between 1935 and 1939, 19 jockeys were killed in races in this country. And there was no insurance for them. They simply couldn't afford the kind of insurance rates they needed, so that they were often rejected from hospitals, and they would simply end up panhandling if they were injured too badly to keep riding. Aside from the danger, there were the struggles with losing weight. The weights that horses carry today are somewhat higher than they were then. Back then, at times, horses would be asked to carry as little as 89 pounds, which meant that the jockey and his saddle and tack had to weigh 89 pounds or less for the horse to run in the race. The less you weighed, the more horses you could ride. And these men would starve themselves, and they would do things to lose weight, like swallowing tapeworms. They would immerse themselves in the track manure pit, which fermented, so it was very hot, and soak there all day. They would not drink anything, to the point of some of them had hallucinations. They were so dehydrated. They beat their bodies up to do what they did.
And this particular jockey, Red Pollard, when you start thinking about, okay, what would be worse than being a jockey? One of the things you might think of, well, I guess you could be a sort of a low-rank prize fighter. And this guy was both.
He was both. Red Pollard is one of my favorite characters in all of sports histories. He was an intellectual. He was self-educated, but he was an intellectual. He read the most difficult literature. He lived on the stuff. He carried books with him all the time. He quoted Shakespeare in the jockey's room. He was abandoned at a racetrack as a boy, and to make ends meet, he had no money and no connections. He began prize fighting part-time in cowtown clubs out in the West, and he was a bad fighter, and he had the stuffing beaten out of him all the time, and then he would go during the day and ride racehorses, and he started out as not a very good jockey. At the time he came to the Seabiscuit Partnership, he was one of the worst jockeys in America, statistically speaking, and he was tremendously accident-prone. He, very early in his career, was struck in the head with something that a horse's hoof had kicked up while riding a horse down the track, and it blinded him in one eye. And that was a secret he pretty much carried to his grave. He told his family, and that was all. Even his friends didn't know, because he would have been banned from racing. He had no peripheral vision. And his time with Seabiscuit was punctuated by injury after injury. He was a very accident-prone, very unfortunate man. He lived the hardest jockey life I know of.
And you also sort of wonder, and again, this might go back to the tendency of Tom Smith and Charles Howard to see potential some in a place that other people would have said didn't have potential. But at the time that they took on Red Pollard, this man was not exactly at the height of his career. In fact, that he was on the way down.
Yes, he really was. He actually, the day he got in that partnership, he had just walked out of a track in Ohio, Thistledown Park. It was called then. It's called Thistledowns today. The last horse he had ridden had simply stopped in the middle of the race, and he most of the time didn't get any mounts at all. And he just kept coming back to the races, and he got in a car that day and went north toward the Detroit Fairgrounds racetrack and was in a car accident and ended up having to hitchhike the rest of the way to the track. And he was down to 27 cents and half a pint of something he called Bow Wow wine when he walked into Tom Smith's barn. And Smith had seen him before out in the Bush Leagues, and he wanted a Bush League kind of rider with a lot of strength, and Pollard had a prize fighter's body. He had a big, strong upper body, and he needed that with Seabiscuit, and he got the job.
I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about Seabiscuit as a kind of popular culture hero and how it is people responded to him and in what way that popular culture status took shape.
I think that a lot of it has to do with the Depression. Excuse me. He comes along in a period of time when America is really down and out. Most people in this country were living in abject poverty at that time, and they were quite desperate for something to escape into and something that offered affirmation. And this was a horse, and these were people that they could identify with. They were all underdogs. They were all individuals who had come from being down and out themselves. And those kinds of individuals were taken as heroes at the time. And Seabiscuit just clicked with the public. And his fame was also helped along a lot by his owner, Charles Howard, who was the original doctor of spin. He was obsessed with good press. He would pull Seabiscuit's shoes off after races and have them cast into silver ashtrays and given to reporters. He was constantly sending the horse's itinerary out so that crowds would gather at every whistle stop from one end of the country to the other. He merchandised the horse to an extraordinary degree. There were Seabiscuit pinball machines and trash cans and playing cards and ladies' hats, and he had two lines of signature oranges, and he endorsed whiskey and a dry cleaning service, a hotel chain. He was everywhere. You couldn't avoid Seabiscuit at the time, and that had an awful lot to do with it, too. Mm-hmm. He's really quite a phenomenon.
Seabiscuit, you mentioned earlier in the interview that Charles Howard bought Seabiscuit for $8,000. How much money did he make off that horse?
I believe 60 times his purchase price in the end. He won $470,000, which was a world record at the time. It's just an extraordinary amount of money when you're talking about what people were earning in those days. It was quite dazzling. He won basically every pricey race in America. He was a juggernaut for 5 years.
And he did, as we talked in the beginning about the fact that Charles Howard was one of the investors in Santa Anita, and that he had this big race, the Santa Anita Handicap, $100,000 purse. Everybody wanted to win, including Charles Howard. And eventually, in his last race, Seabiscuit did win the handicap.
Yeah, and it was just an enormous event. Part of what made it an event that really gathered the whole nation around it was that the horse had been trying to win this race for 4 years, and he just kept running up against incredibly bad fortune every time. He lost the first running by a nose in basically the last jump after an error by Pollard. The second time he lost it after being T-boned by another horse coming out of the starting gate. And the third time he was getting ready to run in it, he suffered a very severe injury to one of his forelegs, which necessitated his retirement. At the same time, Red Pollard had his lower leg virtually sheared off when another horse rammed him into the side of a barn. The two of them, essentially their careers were over, and they spent a year together in retirement on Howard's ranch, walking the fields, building their legs up together, and they came back to take one more try. At that time, Seabiscuit was 7 years old, and that's the equivalent of an Olympic sprinter trying to compete in his late 30s or early 40s. It's quite extraordinary for a horse to come back at that age. And they came back for one last run at the Santa Anita Handicap in 1940 and finally got it.
That's an amazing story, just when you think about what both of them had been through and about the fact, as you say, that they, by all rights, both of them should have been done by that point. Maybe more Red Pollard than Seabiscuit. And for them to both of them come back, and for him to be able to ride the horse and the horse to win this race, you couldn't hardly imagine more of a Cinderella story.
It's just tremendously satisfying, and I actually have put this up on my website. The audio tape of that race is amazing to hear, because there's 80,000 people at the track, and every person in the world wanted that horse to win it. And when he wins it, the crowd, almost everyone in the press box, in their stories about the race the next day, said that they had never heard cheering so loud and sustained, and you can hear it on this audio tape. It's amazing. Thousands of people were weeping. They were running onto the track. People were fainting, and it was hysteria.
Mm-hmm. And it certainly ties in with the way people would have been feeling at the time, and just the idea of a man and a horse coming back against the odds and winning something this big. You can understand how people would have been inspired by that and would grab on to a story like that.
Yes. Yes, it's this partnership and the experiences they had. It looks like America itself in the Depression. It's all of these setbacks and all of this hardship, and to finally succeed in the end was very cathartic, I think, for the whole crowd. People were identifying with this horse to an extraordinary degree. It was quite common for people to weep during his races, and you don't see that with athletes very often.
There's another story about another famous race, an earlier race that Seabiscuit ran against a horse, another famous horse named War Admiral, who had won the Triple Crown in 1937. And this was this race was so big, it was like the Super Bowl of the day. Everybody followed it. Everybody listened to it. And I think there's a story in the book, isn't there, about Franklin Roosevelt actually stopping work. Saying, quitting what he was doing so he could go over and turn on the radio and listen to this race?
Yes, he had a room full of cabinet members. He was supposed to have a meeting, and the race was coming on, and everybody had to stand there and wait while Roosevelt listened to this race. And that was true of the rest of America. America was at a standstill that day. It was November 1, 1938, and 40 million people were listening on the radio, and I believe the American population was 125 million. It's amazing how many people were following this race. It was the showdown of the century in this sport. War Admiral was a titan. He was a Triple Crown winner. He was Seabiscuit's polar opposite, blue-blooded and beautiful and mercurial. Seabiscuit was a plodding, ugly, gentlemanly little horse, and War Admiral was a very heavy favorite, and I believe, and a lot of people would agree with me on this, it was the greatest horse race ever run.
We are a bit past the midpoint here. I just want to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Laura Hillenbrand. She's been writing about thoroughbred racing since 1988. She has been a contributing writer and editor to Equus magazine since 1989, and her work has appeared in a lot of other publications as well. She wrote an article about Seabiscuit in 1998 that appeared in American Heritage, and it won the Eclipse Award for magazine writing, which is the highest journalistic honor in thoroughbred racing. She is the author of a book, and it's a good read. You might want to take a look at it. It's titled Seabiscuit, an American Legend. It's published by Random House. It's out now. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We mentioned a little bit earlier that fact that Seabiscuit's father and grandfather were important horses. His grandfather, particularly Man O' War, was a very famous racehorse. And after this last win, after Seabiscuit won the Santa Anita Handicap, he was retired to stud. Did any of his children go on to become great horses, great racehorses?
They didn't. He had one, probably the best horse that came from his line was a grandson named Sea Orbit, who was similar to him in durability and gameness. He won lots and lots of stakes races on the West Coast, but he was not of the same caliber. Part of it was he didn't live very long. He had a heart attack and died in 1947, only 7 years after going to stud. He was only 14 when he died. And part of it was Charles Howard wanted to keep him at home with him where he lived. And this was an extremely remote ranch in Willits, California, called Ridgewood. And the horse lived out there, actually became a cattle herding horse. Howard taught him to do this just to keep him entertained because he missed racing. But the ranch was so remote that owners of very good mares didn't want to put their mares on trains for this long a train trip. It was rough in those days to transport horses. So not very many came up there, and he ended up not being mated to the best mares in the world. And the result was foals that looked like him, unfortunately, and ran like he did in his earlier career. Most of them were claimers.
Yeah, that's something maybe that people don't follow horse racing might not know, is that in the world of thoroughbred racing, there is no artificial insemination. You got to do it the old-fashioned way, and so for that reason, the two horses have to come together, which is, as I've read some about it, is an extremely delicate business to manage.
Yes, it is. It can be a little dangerous, too. You're talking about great big horses.
Yeah, and certainly it can be dangerous for the humans involved. It also can be dangerous for the horses because, obviously, you don't want either of the horses to be injured in the process.
Yeah, and occasionally you do get good horses get injured in the breeding shed. Yeah, it's a tricky business, but they don't allow artificial insemination, so it's the way it's got to be done.
We have a caller here to talk with in Centralia. Let's do that, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Put this racehorse in relation to Secretariat winning the Belmont. That was the most amazing athletic feat I think I've ever seen.
I would agree with you. And you'd like me to put him in relation to compare him to Secretariat? It's very hard to compare horses of different eras. Racetracks in those days were about 2 seconds or more slower than they are today, so you can't compare horses on time. You have variations in the size of the what are called foal crops, the total number of horses who compete on the track. So you can have a horse who competes in a really big foal crop, and he's basically facing a larger number of horses. And there are lots of variables that make it very difficult to compare horses of different ages. Secretariat was probably the best horse who ever lived. He was a freak. When he was autopsied, his heart weighed 22 pounds. The average equine heart is, I believe, 7 pounds. Mm-hmm. It was the biggest heart ever measured. He was physically a freak, and speed-wise, he was a freak. And I don't know if Seabiscuit could have beaten him, but...
When you said, or I think it was the host that said Michael Jordan, I thought of Secretariat.
Sure. I did, too. Similar athletic gifts, just way off the scale of anybody else.
Yeah, I guess I didn't see all of them, but I think that was probably the only non-human athletic event in ESPN's top 100 or top 50 or whatever it was that they did for the century of athletic events. And that was just, that was amazing to me. It was like a blockhead of...
I agree with you. This is the 1973 Belmont Stakes. The Secretariat won by 31 lengths, if people aren't familiar with it. I believe Bob Costas called it the single greatest big game performance of all time. That performance was so fast that it will take, if the thoroughbred breed continues to improve at the same rate that it is improving now, it will be 2064 before the rest of the breed catches up with that time. That's how fast it was. It was just out of this world. But it's very difficult to compare Seabiscuit to Secretariat. They're very, very different horses. But they're both undeniably among the very, very greatest.
Is there a Secretariat book yet, or are you...
There was a wonderful book written by Bill Knack, who is currently with Sports Illustrated, called Big Red of Meadows Stable. It's now called Secretariat. I highly recommend it. It's a masterpiece.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks for
the
call. Let's go to Champagne next for someone else. You're line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have an interesting question. You mentioned that artificial insemination is not used. Is that so that the parentage of the horse can be definite?
You know what? I'm not too familiar with that. I'm not exactly sure why. I know they allow it in the standardbred breed. Thoroughbred racing is so very traditional. I think a lot of it comes down to tradition.
Oh.
But honestly, I don't. I'm not sure of the reasons behind it. It may be because of parentage, but then again, you can. Horses are genetically typed for parentage now. So I'm really not sure.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. All of this it makes me think, and I guess this is probably an obvious thing for somebody who follows racing, but just how almost magical it is when you get a horse of high caliber. And if anybody could pick him, we'd have a lot more. But it just seems to be, I don't know if it's a matter of luck, if it's chance, if it is, as the case with Seabiscuit, you just have to have the right combination of people. The horse has got to click with the rider and the trainer, and it's all got to come together. And that it sounds as if that's just something that's really rare.
I think it is rare. I think it's probably true with a lot of different kinds of athletes, but maybe true with horses more because they don't speak. They can't tell you, look, you're not training me right. I'd prefer to run 6 furlongs instead of a mile or something of that sort. But, the talent isn't everything, and Seabiscuit clearly had talent that was hidden to the eyes of everyone but Tom Smith, and I am positive that had Tom Smith not seen that horse stop in front of him at Suffolk Downs that day in 1936, that we would never know the name Seabiscuit today.
Hmm. When Seabiscuit beat War Admiral at Pimlico in 38, he became the horse of the year. The horse was elected to the Thoroughbred Racing Hall of Fame in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Smith, who was the trainer, he didn't get into the Racing Hall of Fame until last year.
Yes.
Why did it take so long for the man who was the trainer of this very famous horse, who was in there first, to get into the Racing Hall of Fame?
That's a really good question. It's something that really outraged me and a number of other people that Smith didn't make it. Part of it is, I think, Smith was known as Silent Tom for a reason. He did not speak. He was not a politic guy. He couldn't deal with people very well. He was, as I write in the book, he was gracefully at ease with horses, but with people he was rude and difficult. And I think part of getting into the Hall of Fame is being well-liked by your peers, and I don't think he was. He was a misunderstood man. Part of it was, I think, an incident which occurred in 1946, long after Seabiscuit was retired. He was training horses for Elizabeth Arden Graham, the cosmetic queen. And one of his horses was being prepared for a race. Smith was actually not even there, and a groom was seen spraying something in the horse's nostril. A jockey club official saw it and took the little atomizer that was being used and tested it, and it turned out to have, I believe, 2% ephedrine, which is a decongestant. The groom told the authorities that there were two identical atomizers in the office. He'd merely chosen the wrong one. Any drugs at all were illegal in racing at the time. Ephedrine is not a performance-enhancing drug, but it didn't matter. The horse had been sprayed with this. He did test negative, but he had still been seen being sprayed with it. And as the horse's trainer, Smith was legally responsible for anything his groom did, and he was suspended for a full year. And it caused a lot of outrage in the sport that he was suspended, but the rules were the rules, and he was. And I think that became a black mark on his record that he couldn't live down, and he never did live it down. Until a wonderful journalist named Jay Hovety last year finally lobbied and got him into the Hall of Fame.
We have another call here. This is Philo, line number two. Hello.
Artificial insemination is very effective in horses, but to maintain the high incomes and retain control matings, only natural matings are permitted in the Thoroughbred Association.
Huh. Well, yeah. Thank you. That's good to know.
Now, in addition, though, supplementary drippings from the stallion and from the mare's vagina can be caught and infused back into the mare, but both the mare and the stallion have to be present simultaneously when that is done.
Interesting.
All right. Well, thanks for giving us the additional information. One of the things that I did, I was curious about it just sort of touches on the last thing that you were talking about, the incident involving the ephedrine getting sprayed in the horse's nose. So we go back to the time when Seabiscuit was running before World War II. Were there concerns about various kinds of drugs or substances or what things that could be given to a horse that would improve the horse's performance? And how, at that time, what sort of technologies did they have to try to detect that?
I am not sure if they conducted drug tests yet. I think that was right at the beginning of it, if they were conducting them. Today, horses are drug tested to a remarkable degree. They are tested and tested and tested. Every race in America, horses are tested for drugs now. But then I'm not sure. There was, racing had sort of a PR problem at the time because it had just emerged from an era of a great deal of corruption, which had been started by bookmakers. In the early part of the century, wagering was done entirely through bookmakers, and they had a pretty strong incentive to fix races, and that's what happened. At the turn of the century, lots of races were fixed. And the sport was actually banned in most of the country in the reform movement in the early part of the century until the Depression, when states desperately needed revenue and tracks offered them a cut of wagers in exchange for being allowed to race. And that's how racing was reborn in the 30s. And it was reborn clean. I suppose there had always been a certain level of corruption, but it was, for the most part, gotten rid of at that point. But I'm really not sure if horses were drug tested yet. I never came across anything about Seabiscuit being drug tested or any other horse of that era.
We're getting down to the last couple of minutes, and we have a couple of callers. We'll try to get at least one, if not both. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like just wanted to make a comment relative to the experience of Tom Smith. I think my father fit that pattern. He was a cowboy, or as a young guy, on the Cimarron River and near southeastern Colorado and down the Oklahoma Panhandle. And in those days, the cowboys tended to have a thoroughbred horse around. And my father was one of those who had a thoroughbred horse he gave to his ultimately his wife to be, marriage present. To make a short, long story short, my father did not know anything about breeding and that sort of thing, but he had an eye for a horse, and sounded to me like that was a Tom Smith pattern.
That's
he found he saw a horse. He was racing. He went into racing when he went broke in the cattle business. And he raced in the small tracks in Nebraska and Wyoming, Montana, wherever they had parimutuel racing. He was racing a horse. He was racing in Oxarbon track in Oklahoma and Omaha. I'm sorry. And he saw a horse there that was a good-looking bay horse that raced, and he ran wide in the turns and didn't do anything. He was racing, by the way, at a $600 claiming race. My dad saw that horse, and he ultimately raced again, and he was aware of the fact that the horse was shin bucking at 6 years old. Imagine that. Shin bucks usually occur around two. And so my dad claimed the horse for $600. He got the horse. He laid him up. He took care of his shin buck, got him ready to run. And as he was going home, we were living in Arizona. He stopped off and raced an allowance race in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in the state fair, and he won a race by about six lengths. He later came on and he raced and began to race in all the allowance races at that time, Phoenix Sportsman's Park and those small tracks. And ultimately then, when the horse was winning and setting records, his price kept going up. So my dad sold the horse for a small amount of money, for big money in those days. But the trainer let him, owner had him continue. So he raced then and took him down to Tijuana at the Tijuana Handicap. And that race he ran, and he, unfortunately, he ran, he was making his move. He was a great running horse from behind. And he was making the big move in the stretch, and he broke down with a pop knee. So they took him, dad took him back, and the owner let him take him and take care of him, brought him back. Later, when I was a graduate student at UCLA, he raced then, at that time, he was about probably 7 or 8 years old. He raced in a $10,000 claiming, and he was photo finished. He was beaten by a photo finish on a four-horse finish at Santa Anita.
Wow.
I thought, I just was so taken by your story.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. Those old cowboys really know their horses.
And we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we're out of time. It's a great book. I'm sure that a lot of folks would enjoy reading it. Seabiscuit, an American Legend, published by Random House. It's out now by our guest, Laura Hillenbrand. Ms. Hillenbrand, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.